give thanks for.
You, my premise on the different components of faith, and I'm going to allow you to talk, ask about any of the components, and a lot of them have some interconnections. And so let me go over the components again. I think central to understanding faith in the New Testament is first that faith has an object, which is Jesus. Okay. Which is very clear in the New Testament. I'm just telling you, if you don't think Jesus is the object of faith, as a matter of fact, if you just had faith in Yahweh and didn't have faith in Jesus, it doesn't work. Faith in Jesus is the centerpiece that changes the whole thing. And one sense, it doesn't change anything because it's this theory of the Trinity. Because Jesus is God, you're actually not changing the object of faith. You're clarifying the object of faith and focusing on the one who changed everything. You see, this is why the aspect of the Trinity is very, very important, because then you realize there's this progressive aspect of faith in God that is, the New Testament becomes very laser focused on an individual. Okay, Jesus. Okay, so the object is very central. I'd put that in the middle. And I think I'm going to get a diagram. Second, and it's not second in importance, it's just second in what comes to my mind, is there's a quantitative aspect of faith. Clearly, there are people in the New Testament that had more faith, people had a lesser faith, great faith. Then there's like, you know, we have no faith of a mustard seed. Then there's the thing in James, you know, whoever asks, don't do it wavering, you know, because you're not going to get anything, you know, that type of faith. And so there's a quantitative. Now, you see, this is very interesting because people who focus rightfully on the objective aspect of faith oftentimes have not as much room for the quantitative aspect of faith, because it almost doesn't fit. Is it an object? And what's this degree stuff, you know? And so there's a little bit of tension with our Pentecostal brethren focus much about the quantitative aspect of faith, which I do hold in the components. The third one is that there is a commitment or following aspect of faith. And you get that huge Mark, Luke. John focuses on the object of the faith. Matthew, Mark, and Luke focus on, well, following, but it's following Christ. So there is an object, but there's a greater emphasis on the verb. When you talk about following, it seems like you're doing something. And evangelicals don't tend not to really have a gag response in doing something in order to have our salvation. But there is this following aspect that you can't get away from in understanding the concept of faith. Fourth, there was, I'm going to reorganize it so that it helps my mind here. Fourth, there is a doctrinal aspect of faith because certain doctrines, you know, you're not following, your faith is hopeless. One of the more important ones is the resurrection. Paul says, if you don't believe that the dead are raised in Christ, then your faith is in vain. You see, there is a doctrinal. Now, there's another kind of interesting thing, because sometimes it's how many doctrines, you see. Or some people said, oh, there's none at all. You know, it's all about following Jesus, whoever you think Jesus is. Well, neither one of them are true. It's not too many, but it's not that there's none at all. You see, you understand that. And then because there is a doctrinal, you have an object of faith in Jesus. Well, what kind of Jesus are you talking about? You see? And so it's not just Jesus an object, whatever you think Jesus is and whatever you think Jesus did. No, there's sort of a divine understanding that our faith is in that. So this is a doctrinal, and we could spend time on that. Fifth, and this is probably the most center of the evangelical movement of Christianity. Now, I had a question from one of my former students that I'm still close to, and we dialogue quite a bit, even though it's been like 3-4 years, to give a short definition of what being an evangelical is. Okay. And one of the important things, well, a few important things, is that they tend to have a tie to the Protestant Reformation to distinguish it from Catholicism. Okay. They all have this, and that there's a point of salvation type of thing, that it's a personal commitment. And this point of salvation, and I'll add on this personal commitment, that the evangelical says, you know what? It's not really a matter of whether you were baptized as a child or whether you have went through a catechism. It's a matter of you having personal faith in God, personal. So it's not ritual, it's not traditional, it's personal. Okay, that's a huge aspect of the evangelical, because the evangelical tends never to say, oh, you were born in the faith. Now, you may be raised in the faith, but faith has to be a personal response. Okay, yes, Gene.
Components of faith is whether you can choose to believe or whether faith has to be given to you totally without your choice or without your making a decision.
Oh man, Gene, you asked a really difficult question, that the role of human free choice, which is outside of the boundaries of what we're going to talk about. But because you asked, I'm going to give you an answer. I think, you know what Gene is asking about? This faith, were you chosen in terms of you were never going to do it anyway, but I chose you, so in some way I build in the response that you're going to believe. So are all those people determined by God and chosen by God to do this, to believe? You see, and that's you. The more you hold to that, the more we call you're Calvinistic, you know. And then some would say, no, it's all free will, and it's based then upon God's foreknowledge. Since God knows all things, He knows that you would have chosen Him, but it is of your free will, because it's based not about the will of God or the determination of God. It's based upon the knowledge, foreknowledge of God. Okay, in terms of what you would do. And so there's that other end, and then there's a whole bunch of views in between. Okay. Gene, I saw your hand up.
I had a neighbor who knew that we were believers, and we had sort of touched on the subject a number of times. I was ready to go into deeper discussion with him anytime he wanted, but he didn't want to go there. But he said, I would like to believe what you believe, but I can't. And one of the things that I used to teach in my class is that when we present the gospel in its various forms, or the various people that are grappling with this issue, at some point they have to make a choice. Are you going to follow Jesus or are you not? Are you going to believe in Jesus or are you not? That, I mean, I'm a free will person and I believe that you can choose to believe. Your faith may not barely be a mustard seed, but it's a basis for building a Christian life. Mm. I think both free will and predestination are both true. That's an issue I don't want to fuss with.
Yeah.
But the question is, can you choose to believe? And does every person have to make a choice, or are you just sort of gathered in without even kind of knowing it?
Gene, that's such a deep question you ask. In theology, we would talk about this for, I'd say, 16 hours of lecture. Okay. And we'll try to do it in 6 minutes. Okay. The answer that I think most of you would accept, not all of you, because it depends on the Arminian Calvinist spectrum. And when I taught, I said, you could choose anyone you want within the spectrum. Okay, it doesn't, because I would tell them, at the end, it really doesn't matter whether you chose to follow God of your free will or you determined by the plan of God to follow God. At the end, you're at the same place. I mean, it doesn't change your destiny, you know? And so it in a strange way, there are some views that are a little different, but I would allow my students to be within any spectrum. And I would tell them, but the important thing is that you be consistent. I'd love consistency. I never liked you say you hold to this, but you have to redefine everything, you know? I never liked that. I said, you're disingenuous. You got to be consistent with what you hold, okay, within the faith. Now, if you held to an Arminian view, which is more free will, you would hold as a key cornerstone doctrinal holding, we call it prevenient grace. And prevenient grace is that God knows that mankind has fallen, because that is a centerpiece of reformational thinking, okay? Whether you're Calvinist, Arminian, or Lutheran, everyone's fallen. Bondage of the Will by Martin Luther, he's like, wrote this huge thing, okay? That no one can choose God outside of God helping us. Now, there lies the key term, helping. How much does he help? The more Calvinistic, he helps us so much that he draws us and everyone he draws. I would tell people it's your free will, but he gives you an offer you can't refuse. That I was raised in New York City, so I'm a sort of like the Godfather movies. It's filmed on the streets that I lived in, Mott Street. I mean, I was raised there when I was young. And the Godfather was interesting, you know, with Marlon Brando. It says, we'll give him an offer he can't refuse, you know, whatever, you know. And it's basically, it's your free will, but it's an offer you can't refuse. Okay, so it's like, well, does the Godfather force you to do this? No, he just gives you an offer you can't refuse. You see, it's a strange thing. And so, and that's a bad example, because it's mafioso, you know. But if it's a good example, God, he gives you an offer you can't refuse. That doesn't like contradict your free will, but it's always 100% effective, because he gives you an offer you can't refuse. You say, so you can't offer you can't refuse. Now, that's a more Calvinistic view. Offer you can't refuse. Now, if you're Arminian view, help isn't offer you can't refuse. It's an offer you can refuse.
Oh,
you see the difference? Both involve your free will. One is 100% effective, just like Marlon Brando. The other, you can refuse it. So that in the Arminian view, the Spirit is always working in people through your testimony or through the word, but it's an offer they can refuse, you see. And then, so it's of your free will to refuse it. Yes. Both views have free will as a key component in the process. It's whether you have the decision to, well, it's really interesting. I got to pick my words right. Because even in that you can't refuse one, it's your decision. It's just that there's this coercion that you can't, there's no other choice you can make.
So if we did the scriptures and then studied how people came to Christ, were they given offers they could refuse? Was they given offers they can't refuse? You're going to see on one plane, both hold true in the New Testament. I think the Apostle Paul was given an offer he could not refuse. I mean, how many get this miracle, you know? And then Jesus talks to him, you know? I mean, like, how come we don't get it? He was given an offer you can't refuse. Moses kind of got an offer you can't refuse. But when Peter, Paul, they preach to the masses, they are giving offers that people can refuse. And so we could go theologically deeper. I'm just doing it on a sort of a very light plane so that you understand the concepts. But maybe in a future class, we could go much deeper in this. Jack, I saw your hand up.
Yeah, just quick. I think that's the problem. There's a lot of people out there that don't want to accept an offer. They want to earn it. You know, that's their basic makeup. I can do it. I don't need a freebie. And as less intelligent people that are more like children accept the offer.
Yes, you're making a very profound statement, Jack, because if we were to study all the dialogues that Jesus had with individuals, or Peter or Paul, and the sermons, they almost all, and I'm jumping ahead, fall to, you have to realize something about yourself first. Right.
Yes.
And that they almost all sort of convert on this thing. They might realize different things about themselves, but they all realize something, that they need Christ.
Right.
And there lies, if we had the time to talk about all the dialogues and sermons, I think we would see that. And then the skill, it's like if we had prison ministry, maybe some of you were once in prison ministry or in prison ministry and know someone. It could be that you have to realize, you know, you got to fess up that you robbed that place, you know, stop lying and denying, you know.
Yeah.
Now you're talking to a Silicon Valley like billionaire. What they have to realize isn't that they robbed someone. It's that what they accumulated doesn't help them at the end. That's, you can't put your hope in these things. Now you see, someone who's a criminal, their understanding is different. The CEO is a billionaire. His understanding is different, but there is a tie between them. And there is like something I realized a number of years ago. And it helped me in terms of doing evangelism, because it's not just, you know, do you believe in this? It's, do you believe it in your life when you see yourself? And so you come to these points of understanding. So what, Jack, what you say about people who want to earn their salvation, you know, I'm Chinese, and in the Chinese culture, it's a lot based upon duty, responsibility. Chinese tend to not like handout. We want to earn what we get.
Right.
I read this article about how different ethnic groups, what they look for in a spouse. And I was very interested in the Asian. They said they want someone who's a breadwinner. That's what they want. Someone who's got a night, like financially able. They want a breadwinner, right? And so other ethnic groups, oh, they wanted someone with personality. I'll tell you, Chinese, I don't care about the personality. Do they have a job? Yeah, that's what we want. Do they have a job, you know? And then others would want someone who has status. See, it's Chinese, we don't carry a status. You have a job, you know, type of thing, you know? Actually, when my eldest daughter was dating and was serious, that was what came to my mind. Does this person have a job? You know, I mean, they got a, you know, I don't care how, you know, how charming he is. Doesn't have a job, you know, forget it. You know, and it's like, it fits the MO of my background. Does he have a job? You know? And so, yeah, I don't know how I got into this. I don't even know what I'm talking about now. But each group has a different thing that you're looking for.
Yeah.
And as individuals come to Christ, there are different barriers that you have to recognize. And there might be a dozen of these in the New Testament, but they're examples, and no one knows all of these 12 when they come to Christ. But there's one that is truly holding them back from making Christ the object of the faith. You see? Yes, who's that?
That's Frank.
I can't. Oh, yeah, Frank.
Yeah, I did my little hand thing. I don't know where it
is. I couldn't see it.
So, no, it disappeared off the screen here. But here's my question. And it's a reformed orientation, but it's the inclination of our hearts. That's a fundamental issue. If our hearts are not inclined.
Oh, you froze, Frank.
Yeah.
It was, I'll tell you, Frank's a Calvinist. It's the will of God. No, I'm just joking, Frank. It's the will of God that you cannot complete. I'll complete it. It's the inclination of heart. And he's probably going to say that it's the spirit that must break this thing. And that it's going to be effective because once it's broken, you see. And Frank is one of the most consistent of the theological thinking that I, in terms of talking with people, is very, very consistent in how he thinks. Okay, so if Frank comes back, I'll let him complete it. But Gene, you are an Arminian, and on the and this is the weirdest thing about this class: we have a Frank the Calvinist and Gene the Arminian in the same class. Okay, Gene, you have your hand up.
Well, I'm going to try to get off these questions, but there's a related question to what I've been asking, is whether you can choose faith. Another thing is there are people in the class, in my class, who come every week and who more or less seem to accept the teaching, seem to at some level relate positively to Jesus, but they never commit. They never actually get with the program. They never actually commit to being a believer, to joining the church, to getting involved in Christian life in specific ways. They go along to a certain point and then they never commit. And that's another point that I would always hammer as the leader.
Yeah.
That there comes a time when every person has to choose either commit or not to commit. And some people go through the whole year, coming every week, but they do not commit, and they haven't objected. So, and then I'm just going to try to be quiet and let you go on.
Gene, you asked that question is the million-dollar question, because ultimately, when I taught theology, it always goes back to practice and what I saw as a pastor for 30 years. People attend church, they don't really, maybe different degrees of living their life for Christ. So on one level, you get some person who just CEO Christian, Christmas and Easter only. So you got these people and they check, I'm a Christian box, CEO, Christmas, Easter only. Okay, so you got that type of Christian, okay. But they'll always identify themselves as Christian. You see, they'll check the box. And then you have people who are even, who are like that, but maybe come once a month. Okay. Then you got people who come twice a month. Then you got people who come every month. Then you got people who come every week and then serve. And then they actually follow, they grapple with sin types, things like that. I see the whole spectrum. And one of the things that I developed this concept of faith is that within it, I don't separate as much the following commitment aspect. I see it as a part of what the faith is, rather than it's the second step you need. So you need to commit. You believe, now you need to commit. I actually see it's kind of all in the same thing, you know, faith. Now, none of us have all six complete, but we're growing in these things. But there's so many people who are CEO Christians or once a month Christians that identify themselves as a faith. Most of my relatives on my wife's side, my nieces and nephews on my wife's side, are kind of nominal. And so what do you do with them? They're raised in church. They're not really committed, you know. But they all identify themselves as Christ, yeah, you know, as Christians. And so that's a huge, huge thing, which one of the things I want to get to is that if you just say, and Gene and to everybody else, all it takes to be a Christian is to confess your sin, you know, and say this prayer. Then we focus on this accepting aspect, which I didn't ever got to. It's the fifth one. That's the accepting aspect, but we never tie it to the following aspect of it. So fifth is the acceptance aspect, which is the gift, which evangelicals tend to love. Okay. The sixth one is the trust aspect, which is peace. So there's these six aspects that are floating around with the object of Jesus being at the very center. As to how each one ties together, there lies how you refine your theology. I think we recognize that all six are there. How they intertwine and how necessary or how much will one develop into another, that is all open to a degree of discussion and debate. And many of the systems of theology revolve around how these six interact, you see. And so I don't know if we'll ever get to that. If you ever do and you ever figure out what you are, you're very pretty advanced theologically. Okay. So yeah, it's a big issue. People, they come to class, they're not quite there. And you know, one of the things I realized that in my pastoring, no one is ever perfect as a believer. As I think someone said about faith of a mustard seed, I think it was Eddie last week, you know, we're like, the best of us are like 2%, you know, good, you know, following on track, you know, we're like between zero. Okay. I'm not going to say we never have zero, but like one, 0.001 to 2%. Okay. So that's the realm of the Christian growth. Okay. And the 98, we wait for eternity. Okay, so we're dealing with this small growth thing, and none of us will be perfect. I think of all these people that came closest were Paul. You know, he got high. You know, he would talk about attain to a better resurrection. He's talking about this type of stuff of put his body, you know, beat his body so that he may win. You know, what's he talking about? You know. I mean, that doesn't seem like it's a free gift if you're beating your body so you could win the race, you know, and they'd say, oh, only one wins the race, you know. So he's saying, oh, is he saying just only one person is a Christian and saved? No, he's not talking about that. He's talking about the following aspect combined with the quantitative aspect, which drives the believer to live more for Christ. Now, it's like, well, does everyone have that? There lies an interesting question. Every believer have that? I'd say I see a lot of them that don't. So the question is, are they Christians? There lies, it's huge. You see how they connect with each other, because there are explanations theologically for all these different views. You see, and the degrees of how you put them together. Okay. Okay. Anyone else have anything to say? We have, I think I'm going to go with, I review the six. It was the object. It was the quantitative. It was the following. It was doctrinal. Fifth was the gift accepting aspect. Has a little bit more salvation. There's a point. which seems to go against this following thing, which is a process. It's a point, you see. And then the sixth one, it's a something of a peace that you have within, because there are people who can accept and follow, and they're the most sad people you ever want to meet. But we've committed and we followed. And why are you so sad? You see, it doesn't, having two or three of these doesn't mean you have all of them. Why are you so sad then? See, it's a different component, but it's part of it. But then you could have people that just practice all sorts of meditation and they're at peace and they don't do anything for Christ, you know? Like that, there's something wrong there, you know? And so we'll try to talk about what these are and how they intertwine. And what I would want is that each one of us have a number of areas to always grow in and to, you know, ask God, you know, where do I grow in? How do I grow in this component? Mavis, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I just want to ask, so for those who believe in predestination, and then they are in various stage of this faith, so they believe it's God's call.
Yes.
And how do we talk to them that you have some choices there to make, yeah, and you have some responsibility there to make? It's not like you just passively sit there and wait for the timing to come. Because a lot of people believe in that. So how do we talk to them?
Yes. It's very difficult because in the Calvinistic system, there's a lot of degrees. If we talked about Calvinism, let's say there's like, of the high variety, maybe four different views and how they are talked about. So one is you have to figure out which degree are they. Are they extra hot, spicy? You know, they one alarm chili Calvinist, two alarm chili Calvinist, three, four, you know, mouth burning Calvinist, you know? And how you, knowing them helps you understand how to interact with them. Okay. Like one of the things, and this is a sad story. My daughter went to UCLA. Both my daughters went to UCLA. And the oldest one was involved with John MacArthur's Grace on Campus. A lot of UCLA students were involved in Grace on Campus, which was John MacArthur's church's ministry. And John MacArthur is very Calvinistic, a lordship Calvinistic when it comes to theology. And as my daughter grew, she was raised in church, she went to, you know, involved in church, began to then got married and have kids and keep in contact with her believing friends at UCLA, she made a very interesting observation. She said, what I found is a lot of these UCLA students that went to Grace on Campus would have swore up and down that to be genuine Christian, you have to be like, you know, gung-ho and fully committed to Christ, because that's the position of John MacArthur. And he said, only to know that many of my friends have fallen away from the faith. And that she said, there's this problem of people saying, oh, you can do it, you can do it. And then, you know, when you get married and, you know, you have kids, it's like they're not there anymore. And she said that there's a problem there, because how can you be so committed to lordship? And then all of a sudden, when you get into real life, you dropped because within that view, there is such a high commitment, and the commitment area is so high that anything less, and that's hard. That's very, very hard when someone holds to that, because usually when someone holds to that high degree of lordship, if you're young, it's usually because you haven't faced hardship yet, you know? And so you could point your finger, oh, you know, you're so too carnal and stuff like that, you know, you're too carnal, you know? And then when you've been around and you yourself experience things and trouble and you have kids, you know, you realize, maybe it's not as that simple as you think, you know, and you mellow out. So there's that type of Calvinist. There's another type of Calvinist like John Piper, who is, and I remember I was acquaintances of John Piper. He would evangelize because he's commanded to evangelize. And so he never went back to say, oh, if God preordained them, you know, they'll come to Christ. You know, he says, no, we have to pray for people. We have to share the gospel with people because we were told to. Okay. Now, so it's a different type. You see how he lives out his faith is different, but he tended to be very critical person. And that's why he took some time off from his ministry at the end of his pastoral life at Bethlehem Baptist. He realized he was too critical of a person, not gracious enough. And he said that publicly. And it takes a humble man to someone who got into a stature, wrote dozens of books, who says, you know, I grew up just criticizing everybody. You know, it's like, that's not a good thing. But he admitted it. Now, he held to a view that's very interesting. It was called best of all worlds. He held that everything has been predetermined by God. Every choice has been predetermined by God. And in the plan of God, in how he, when he was choosing which plan would pan out, there were trillions upon trillions of possibilities. He chose the one that would show the most grace and give him the most glory. So it's a matter of all, and it's known as the best of all worlds under a type of Calvinism. Now, I would always teach this, and I bring up the article, and you know, Desiring God article, Best of All Worlds, and the students would be shocked. So what is this Best of All Worlds? Because they're trying to logically understand how things operate. So that type of Best of All Worlds, some Calvinists hold. I can't hold it. I don't hold the Best of All Worlds. Because the best of all worlds is that he chose that which shows most grace, that gives him the most glory. But it could have been a choice where all of us go to hell. That's a very interesting thing. He could, or half of us, you know, are in hell, and half of us, and it'd be okay because it brings God the most glory. I find that too, I don't know, I find it too difficult to accept, because hell to me is a very, I don't want to go there, you know, I don't want to go there. And I think, and so there's that type of Calvinist. Okay. And then there are some Calvinists like, let's say Tim Keller or D.A. Carson, who's on the lighter portion. So let's say John Piper's on heavy duty, you know, and then John MacArthur's pretty heavy duty too. And then got D.A. Carson, who would say, no, the determined will of God is there, but within it is built in human free will. I don't know how it works, but it's built in the determined plan of God. You see how he doesn't in detail explain what his view is. In one sense, he knows of the tension. He gives deference to the plan of God because that sits on top, but he doesn't deny human free will. As to how they operate, he doesn't spend as much time in doing that. You see how they're all a little different? It's the degree of where you emphasize and where you focus. And each one has a different aspect. You could even have fatalistic Calvinists, which none of those three hold, where, oh, God just determined it. You know, we just have to follow it. You know, God is, everything has been determined. And that's a fatalistic Calvinist. And there's no theologically sound Calvinist I hold who is a fatalist. Okay. But you have fatalistic Calvinists. Now, in each and every one of them, there's a theological, I have the most respect for D.A. Carson, and I like the way how he explains it, even though I might not be as strict as he is. I tend not to like John MacArthur or John Piper when it comes to that the deeper explanation. But each one, and this is why it's very important when I taught my students that they not just say, oh, they're Calvinist Arminian. All Calvinists are like this, all Arminians. No, they're not. There's like all these different varieties. And when you know the varieties, you then have the advantage of knowing how to minister to them. You see, what kind of variety are they? You know, what kind of Calvinist are they? What kind of Arminian are they? What kind of Pentecostal are they? What kind of charismatic are they? And I tended not to have reductionistic explanations. You know, there are two types of people in this world, Calvinists and Arminians. Oh, that's so wrong. That's so bad. A lot of different gray areas. And so when you talk to them, sometimes it's just waiting for them to experience life and realize how difficult it was. It's like one of my professors at seminary who greatly influenced me was a professor by the name of Zane Hodges. The Calvinists hated Zane Hodges, hated him because he held to something called free grace, that believers can die in their sins, which a Calvinist would, they can't. Believers always grow. They can't die in their sin, you know. And Zane says, oh, people can die in the sin. And I asked Zane, I said, I was once in his office. I said, how did you come up with this view? And the thing about Zane Hodges is that he said, well, Jeff, I ministered to the Mexican community in Dallas, Texas in the 60s. And he would go door to door. You know, some were established Mexican-Americans, some were migrant, you know, just coming for a job. It's probably something illegal, you know, in the 60s. And he said to me, you realize when you minister to poor people that they don't always have their life together. And I had to understand that you can't have a theology that works just for wealthy people who have their life together, that you have to also have a gracious enough view of God that you can actually minister to poor people who are actually dealing with very basic things about life and that they struggle. And I think you see that. I think many of you are involved with the recovery ministry and Step Closer, and you realize they fall off the wagon, you know? And it's like, wow, well, wealthy people in Los, you know, in Palo Alto, we don't have that problem. So I guess we're better Christians. You just started at a better place. You know, it's not here you're a better Christian, you started at a better place. And so I would test my students to say, okay, there's this whole degree of people in this world. Is your theology based upon a socioeconomic standard that gives them an advantage of their faith? Or do you actually, your theology can work with poor people who are starving someplace or who were raised in the wrong side of the track or people with low IQ, you know? Does your faith, and so you really have to develop a faith, an understanding of faith that deals with all of people. Yeah. And that's, you know, I think one of the issues I have with Calvinism is they tend to attract upper middle class group, and they cannot minister well with poor people.
Yeah,
because of the, I don't know, it's just something I observed, and there's a flaw in there that too. There's a then why is it so? You see, why is it so? And so as we move into other classes, yes, Frank.
Yeah, so I want to make a comment on that because I understand, given the examples you've taken, if God's prevailing love is the effective way we come to know him, then I think some of this harshness that we talk about is eliminated. I'm actively involved with recovery ministry.
Yes,
I understand. You know, the struggles and the things. And yet the one thing I hear time and time again, more clearly from this group of men, is that they understand that God loves them and it's his loving hand that has drawn them. In other words, it's easy for me to sit here and say, well, I'm theologically astute, whatever, and I can navigate all this stuff. They're fundamentally very oriented toward the work of grace in their own lives and God's immeasurable and prevailing love. So I want to make that clear.
Yeah.
And I understand the harshness that you're talking about, especially with Piper, where he's coming from. I mean, you can get into scholasticism and all that other nonsense that was propagated. I don't hold those views, obviously. Yeah. Okay, and I'll just stop at that.
Yeah, Frank, thanks for sharing, because Frank's very committed to ministry, to regardless of which socioeconomic background you're coming from. And I really give kudos to Frank's theological position. It's very consistent, and it shows the heart of the ministry for people of all types of people. At the end, that's what you want. Theology that is consistent, but also reflects in the heart of how you minister to people. It's just that you don't want to go into the difficult parts of theology where you can fence people off because they're not, they didn't meet this level or something like that, you know?
Yeah, and I agree with that, obviously.
Yeah. Yes. Lynn, you have your hand up.
There's a couple of things that, if you touched on it, I missed it, but there's a couple of things that I'd like to bring up. One is that it smacks of the different positions in different ways, smack of works and the role that we can work out our salvation in fear and trembling, how in heaven's name that works. Then the other thing is that it also seems that we need to take into account that we don't get rid of the flesh this side of glory.
I think, this whole works, I don't think any healthy Arminian or Calvinist would say it's of works.
Okay.
You have some erroneous kinds of Arminians, maybe if you tend to what we call, and now I'm going to throw out terms where you might not say, what is Jeff talking about? The holiness camp of Protestants may not truly understand the classic Arminian grace-based understanding of salvation. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like us talking to some African-American brethren 2 weeks ago. We were doing some Zoom taping. Every other week we do tapes on minorities and ministry. And so we're focusing on African-American ministry. And one of them was raised in the traditional African-American denomination, COGIT, COGIC, Church of God in Christ. There are various traditional African-American denominations that sprung up after emancipation because African-Americans were not welcomed in, white churches. So they had to develop their own denominations. COGIT is one of these old ones. Church of God is another one. There are different Church of God denominations. It's a black variety of the Church of God. And he was saying that what you have is the African-American youth are leaving these churches because he used this term, you have to be booted and suited to worship at these churches. Mm. You got to wear your nice suit. You got to wear your nice shoes. The women have to wear the nice hats. So he's saying the youth that he used to bring to the Koja church, they're in clean t-shirts, And they'd say, oh, what? These people can't serve because they're not suited and booted. And it's the first time I heard an African-American talk about this. And he says, they got to accept these people the way they're coming in. They're not, these kids are not dressed, in nice shoes and suit and a nice hat, That's of another generation of the African-American church. And so you have this form of legalism and works orientation in these traditional denominations. A lot you see in the old school African-American ones. That's why the African-American denominations, old ones, are in real crisis. AME, the one there, it's old school African-American. That's why, if you look in the area where we are, PBC, Abundant Life is a much more vibrant ministry than Zion Church. You know, you say why? Because one is traditional African-American. African-Americans are running from that. They're going to multi-ethnic Black-led churches, even though the current Abundant Life church, pastor is white now, but they had a series of African-American churches that is breaking the legalism of the African-American church. Cogit is dying. Church of God is dying because they have this legalistic sort of bent to them. Okay, so what you say about Smacks of Works, yeah, it's there in some of these places. Some of the old school church of the Nazarene have real holiness. Some of the new ones, they don't. They got rid of it, but some of the old ones do. And yeah, its part is, you know, we're talking about the 2% of growth here. None of us will ever say that we've completed getting rid of the flesh. You're always kind of warring and fighting with some degrees of it, you know? So that's, I don't know if I spent time, but it's 9:59.
Whoa.
We got to go. So hold your questions for next week. And I'm going to try to pray that I get toilet paper at Costco in the afternoon. See you. Oh, it's 10 o'clock. See you next week. Bye.
I extra if you want to drive down.
I might, Lynn. Take care.